Creators are gathered around a map on a massive table. As one, they turn.
Nephew?
I recognize Janus Atreus, Dex's uncle and the pater of Jens Atria. He nods a quick greeting at his nephew before saluting me. I cannot read his features, but he glances askance at Karis before speaking, a look I am not meant to miss, I think.
Shrike, have you been briefed?
Half of the southwest quarter is on fire, I say. That's all the briefing I need. Why are we not fighting back? Night won't fall for hours. We need to use the light that remains. Janus and a few of the other paters mutter their agreement, but the rest shake their heads, a few raising their voices in dispute. Admiral Argus and Vice Admiral Vesalius exchange a look of disgust that I make note of. I won't find an ally in either of them.
Bloodshrike.
The Commandant has finished with the runners, and her cool voice silences the room. Despite the hatred that rises in me at her patronizing tone, I admire the way she wields her power. Though the men in this room are lords of their own gens, not a single one will defy her.
We expected you days ago.
She glances at the paters and navy officers. Are yours to command. This woman trained all expression from my face, but it is difficult not to show my surprise. As Bloodshrike, I am a superior officer, and the Emperor sent me to take command of Navium's defense. But I did not expect the Commandant to give it up so easily. I did not expect her to give it up at all. Harper gives me a warning look.
Don't act the part she's written for you.
Karis, I hide my wariness. Why do we not have boats in the water?
The weather is treacherous, Shrike. For the past few weeks, storms have moved in swiftly.
She walks to the tall windows that look south. From here I can see the whole coast, along with the distant masts of a massive Karkan fleet.
That cloud bank, she nods to it, has been there for 3 days. The last time we took the fleet out, the weather was similar.
Leonidas knew sea weather better than anyone.
Leonidas ignored the orders of a superior officer simply because she commands an army instead of a navy.
Admiral Argus leads one of the more powerful Mercator gens, and his rage at his lost ships is clear.
General Veturia ordered him not to take out the fleet, and he didn't listen. We all,
he gives the room a glower,
supported Leonidas's execution.
Not all,
Janus Atreus says stiffly. Leonidas is not the point, I say. The old man is dead, and while he didn't deserve to die in disgrace, this is not a battle I can win. Karis, have you been in the southwest quarter since the attack began? Argus pushes forward, planting himself in front of me like a squat, belligerent toad.
The Commandant has...
Beside me, Dex half draws a sim. Interrupt me one more time, Argus, I say, and I'll have Captain Atreus make me a necklace of your entrails. The paters fall silent, and I let them consider the threat before I speak. Paters, I say, I won't launch the fleet without your approval, but consider our losses. More than 1,000 killed already, and dozens dying by the hour. I've seen children with their limbs blasted off, women trapped beneath rubble dying slowly. Grimmar the Corkin is a vicious foe. Will we let him take our city?
Most of the city is safe, Vesalius argues. It is only the southwest quarter that is...
Just because they're not Mercators or Illustrians doesn't make their lives any less valuable. We have to do something. Karis holds up a hand to silence her allies.
The watchtower ballistae are too far from the ships to do any real damage.
I cut her off. What in the skies was your plan? To sit here and just let them destroy us?
Our plan was to allow them to believe they could storm the city, the Commandant says, When they made the mistake of landing their troops, we would wipe them out. We would launch an attack on their ships. She points this out on the map. From a nearby cove, where we would move the fleet at night. We would stop the Karkin ground forces while still capturing their ships, which would replace those the Mercators lost in the attack on the harbor. The bleeding weather has nothing to do with this after all. She wants the barbarian ships. She wants them so she can get Narvium's paters in her pocket, all the better to secure their support when she tries to take down Marcus again. And you were planning to do this when, exactly? We expected 3 more weeks of siege. We've been choking off their supplies. Dremar and his men will run out of food eventually. Once they finish with the southwest quarter, I say, they'll move to the southeast. You're willing to allow dozens of neighborhoods, thousands of homes, to be besieged for nearly a month. There are more than 100,000 people living. We are evacuating the southern parts of the city, Shrike. Not fast enough. I consider. We must protect Narvium, of course. But I smell a trap. Harper taps a thumb on his sim hilt. He senses it too. And yet I cannot let Grimar murder my people at will. Admiral Argus, how long to prepare the fleet?
We could launch by second bell, but the weather...
We will engage the Karkins at sea, I say, and though I promised I'd get the pages' permission, I have no time for it. Not when every minute brings more martial deaths. And we will do it now.
I'm with you, Shrike.
Janus Atreus steps forward, as do a half dozen other paters and officers. Most, however, are clearly opposed.
Consider, Karras says, that the fleet is our only defense, Shrike. If a storm comes in...
You and I both know, I say quietly, that this has nothing to do with the weather. I glance at Dex, who nods, and Harper, who watches the Commandant fixedly. His expression is unreadable.
Don't act the part she's written for you.
In the end, I might be playing into her hands, but I'll just have to concoct a way out of whatever trap she's laid for me. These are the lives of my people, and come what may, I cannot leave them to die. Admiral Argus? My tone brooks no disapproval, and though his eyes are rebellious, one look from me quells it.
Launch the fleet.
After an hour, the men are mustered, and the laborious process of dropping the sea chains begins. After 2 hours, the fleet sails from the circular warport and into the merchant harbor. After 3, our men are locked in combat with the Karkins. But after 4 hours, the sky, thick with clouds and rain, deepens from a threatening gray to an eerie dark purple. And I know we are in trouble. Lightning cracks across the water, striking mast after mast. Flames leap high, distant bursts of light that tell me the battle is turning, and not in our favor. The storm comes suddenly, roiling toward Narvium from the south, as if whipped forth by a wrathful wind. By the time it hits, it is far too late to turn the fleet back.
Admiral Argus has sailed these seas for 2 decades,
Dex says quietly as the storm intensifies.
He might be Karras's dog, but he'll bring the fleet home. He'll have no wish to die.
I should have gone with them, but the Commandant and Harper and Dex all protested. The one thing the three of them agreed on. I seek out Karras, who speaks quietly with one of the drum tower runners.
No reports yet, Shrike, she says. The drum towers cannot hear anything over the storm. We must wait.
The runner steps away, and we are, for a moment, alone.
Who is this Grimar? I ask her. Why do we know nothing about him? He's a zealot, a warlock priest who worships the dead. He believes it is his spiritual duty to convert all those who are unenlightened.
That includes the Marshals. By killing us.
Apparently, Karras says softly. He's a relatively young man, a dozen or so years older than you. His father traded furs, so Grimmar travelled the Empire extensively as a boy. To learn our ways, no doubt. He returned to his people a decade ago, just as a famine hit. The clans were starving, weak, and malleable. The Commandant shrugs. So, he moulded them. I'm surprised at the depth of her knowledge, and she must see it on my face.
What is the first rule of war, Bloodshrike?
Know your enemy. I don't even have to say it. I look out at the storm and shudder. The gale feels fey, wild. Thinking of what will happen if our fleet succumbs makes my stomach churn. We sent out nearly every vessel, holding back only a dozen ships. Night approaches, and still we have no word. We cannot lose the fleet. We are the Empire, the Marshals. Argus's men are trained for this. They've seen storms far worse. I cycle through every scrap of hope I can claw from the recesses of my mind. But as the minutes pass, the distant flashes of battle continue unabated. And those flashes that are closer to Navium, those that belong to our fleet, grow fewer and fewer.
We should put up the sea chains, Shrike,
the Commandant finally says. The paters agree with a dozen angry eyes.
Our fleet is still out there.
If the fleet survives, we will know in the morning, and we can lower the chains. But if they do not, then we keep the Karkans from penetrating to the heart of Navium.
I nod my assent, and the order is given. The night drags on. Does the storm carry the shrieking taunts of Karkan warlocks? Or is that just the wind? Hope is stronger than fear. It is stronger than hate. I said those words to the Nightbringer, and as night deepens to an impenetrable blackness, I hold on to them. No matter what dawn brings, I will not give up hope. Soon the sky pales, the clouds thin and roll back. The city is swept clean and sparkling, the red and grey roofs gleaming in the wan sunlight. The sea is as smooth as glass. And, except for the mass of Corkan ships bobbing well off the coast, it is empty. The Marshal fleet is gone.
Impossible.
You did not listen. The pater who speaks is the head of Gen Serica, a wealthy family of silk merchants who have long been established in the south. My father considered him a friend. The man is pale. His hands shake. There is no venom to his words because he is in shock.
And the fleet? The city?
I did warn you, Bloodshrike.
As Karras speaks, the hairs on the back of my neck rise. Her gaze is cold, but the spot of triumph she's buried deep within shows itself.
What the skies?
We just lost the entire bleeding fleet, thousands of men. Even the Commandant couldn't have anything to rejoice in the death of her own people. Unless that was her plan this entire time. Which I now realize, it must have been. In one swoop, she has undermined my authority, destroyed my reputation, and guaranteed that the paters will turn to her for guidance. And all it cost her was the entire bleeding fleet. The plan is repugnant, evil, and because of that, I did not even consider it. But I should have.
Know your enemy.
Bleeding skies. I should have realized she would never hand over power so easily. And yet, she couldn't have known the storm was coming. None of us could have. Not with the sky so clear and the threatening cloud bank so distant. Suddenly, and far too late for it to be any use,
I remember the Nightbringer. After delivering me to the island, he disappeared. I thought nothing more of him. But what of his power? Can he create storms? Would he? And if so, would the Commandant have requested it of him? She could have proved my incompetence in 1,000 ways. Losing the entire fleet seems excessive. Even with me out of the way, how will she defend Narvium with no navy? No. Something else is going on, some other game. But what is it? I look to Dex, who shakes his head, stricken. I cannot bring myself to look at Harper.
I will go to the beach to see if anything can be salvaged from the wrecks, the Commandant says. If I have your leave, Shrike.
Go. The paters file out of the room, no doubt to take the news to the rest of their gens. Karis trails them. At the door she stops. Turns. She is the Commandant again, and I the ignorant student. Her eyes are exultant and predatory. The exact opposite of what they should be, considering our loss. Karis smiles, a smirk from a murderess sharpening her blades for the kill. Welcome to Narvium, Bloodshrike.
Chapter 17. A Liar. The night is deep when we arrive at Musa's safe house, a forge that squats in Edessa's central shipyard just beyond the Scholar refugee camp. At this hour, the shipyard is empty, its silent streets eerily shadowed by the skeletons of half-built vessels. Musa does not even glance over his shoulder as he unlocks the forge's back door. But I am uneasy, unable to shake the sense that someone, something, watches us. Within a few hours, that feeling is gone, and the yard thunders with the shouts of builders, the pounding of hammers, and the protesting creak of wood as it is bowed and nailed into place. From my room on the forge's upper level, I peer down into a courtyard, where a grey-haired scholar woman stokes an already roaring fire. The cacophony surrounding this place is perfect for clandestine weapon-making. And Musa said he'd get Darin whatever supplies he needs, which means my brother must make weapons. He is out of excuses. I, on the other hand, might still find a way out of the bargain Musa insisted on.
You will help me resurrect the Northern Scholar's resistance.
Why has Musa not done it already? He has resources, and there must be hundreds of scholars who would join up, especially after the Empire's genocide. Something else is going on. Something he's not telling me. After a much-needed bath, I make my way downstairs, clad in a wool dress of deep red and soft new boots that are only a little big. The ping of steel on steel echoes in the courtyard, and two women laugh over the din. Though the courtyard houses the forge, the building I'm in has the personal touches of a house. Thick rugs, a shawl thrown over a bureau, and cheerful tribal lanterns. At the foot of the stairs, a long, wide hall leads to a drawing room. The door is ajar, and Musa's voice carries through.
"Very knowledgeable, and can assist you," Musa says. "When can you start?"
A long pause.
"Now, but it will take me a bit to get the formula right. There is much I don't remember."
Darin sounds stronger than he has in weeks. Rest and a bath must have done him good.
"Then I'll introduce you to the smiths here. They make pots, pans, horseshoes, enough household items to justify the amount of ore and coal we'll need."
Someone clears her throat loudly behind me. The sounds of smithing have stopped, I realize, and I turn to find the silver-haired, brown-skinned scholar woman from the courtyard. She wears a burn-scarred leather smock, and her face is wide and pretty. Beside her, a young woman, who is clearly her daughter, watches me with dark green eyes that sparkle in curiosity.
Liar of Sarah, the older woman says. I am Smith Zeller, and this is my daughter, Tore. It is an honor to meet the heir of the Lioness. Zeller clasps my hands between her own. Do not believe the lies the mariners spread about your mother, child, she says. They are threatened by you. They wish to hurt you.
What lies? We've heard all about what you did in the Empire.
Tore speaks up breathlessly, and the admiration in her tone alarms me.
It was luck, mostly. You mentioned my mother.
Not luck. Musa strolls out of the drawing room, Darin in tow. Lyra clearly has her mother's courage, and her father's sense of strategy. Zella, show Darin where he'll be making weapons, and get him what he needs. Lyra, come inside, if you please. Lunch awaits.
The two Smiths leave with my brother, Tore with one last reverent glance over her shoulder, and I fidget as Musa waves me into the drawing room. What sky's forsaken stories did you tell them about me? I hiss at him.
I said nothing.
He piles a plate with fruit, bread and butter, and hands it to me.
Your reputation precedes you. The fact that you nobly sacrificed yourself for the good of the refugee camp helped.
My skin tingles warningly at the smugness on his face. Why exactly would he look so pleased about it? Did you plan for Darin and me to be captured?
I had to test you somehow, and I knew I could spring you from prison. I made sure Captain Aliba knew you were coming into the city. Anonymously, of course. I knew if you were the leader I hoped you were, you'd never let your people suffer while you cowered. And if you weren't, I'd have dragged you out of hiding and turned you over myself.
I narrow my eyes at him. What do you mean? Leader?
It's just a word, Lyra. It won't bite. In any case, I was right.
How dare you make those poor people suffer? They lost their homes, their belongings. The mariners ripped that camp apart.
Calm down, Musa rolls his eyes. No one died. The mariners are too civilized for such tactics. Captain Aliba and I have our differences. But she's an honorable woman. She has already replaced their tents. By now she will know it was me who gave up your whereabouts, of course. She'll be hopping mad about it, too. But I can deal with her later. First we...
We!
First, Musa clears his throat pointedly. You need to eat. You're irritable. I don't like talking to irritable people.
How can he take all of this so lightly? I take a step toward him, my hands curling into fists, temper rising. Almost immediately, a force shoves me back. It feels like 100 sets of tiny hands. I try to squirm away, but the hands hold me tight. On instinct, I try to disappear, and I even flicker out of sight for a moment. But to my shock, Musa grabs my arm, unaffected by my magic, and I flicker back into view.
I have my own magic, Liar of Sarah, he says, and the mirth has left his face. Yours doesn't work on me. I know what Shaver said. You discussed it with your brother on your way here. Your answers lie in Adisa, with the beekeeper. But beware, for he is cloaked in lies and shadow, like you. The magic is my lie, Liar, as it is yours. I can be your ally, or I can be your enemy. But either way, I will hold you to your promise to help resurrect the resistance.
He releases me, and I scramble away, straightening my dress, trying not to show how much his revelation has rattled me. It just seems as if this is a game to you, I whisper. I don't have time to help you with the resistance. I need to stop the Nightbringer. Shaver told me to look for the beekeeper. Here you are. But I thought
You thought I would be a wise old man, ready to tell you exactly what you must do to stop the djinn? Life is rarely so simple, Laya. But be assured that this is no game. It is the survival of our people. If you work with me, you can succeed in your mission to bring down the Nightbringer, while also helping the scholars. For instance, if we work with the King of Marin, I snort.
You mean the king who has a price on my head, I say. The one who ordered men and women and children who have seen genocide to be put in camps outside the city instead of treated like humans. That king. I push my plate away, frustrated now, food half eaten. How can you help me? Why would Shaver send me to you?
Because I can get you what you need,
Musa tips his seat back.
It's my specialty. So tell me, what do you need?
I need to be a mind reader, to have fey powers beyond disappearing, to be a mask. I need eyes on the Nightbringer, I say, and on his allies. The prophecy said he needed only one more piece to complete the star. I need to know if he has found it. Or if he's close. I need to know if he's cozying up to anyone, gaining their trust. Their love. But saying the words aloud makes me feel hopeless. How am I supposed to accomplish that?
I have it on good authority that he's in Navium now, and has been for the past month.
How did you...
Don't make me say it again, Liar of Sarah. What do I do?
You watch. My relief is so keen that I'm not even irritated at Moose's arrogance. You listen. How fast can you get me information on the djinn? Musa strokes his chin.
Let's see. It took me a week to learn that you'd broken Elias out of Blackcliff's dungeons. 6 days to learn that you'd set off a riot in Nur. 5 to learn what Elias Veturius whispered in your ear the night he abandoned you in the tribal desert for Koff prison. 2, to learn that the warden...
Wait! I choke out. The room suddenly feels warm. I have tried not to think of Elias, but he haunts my thoughts, a ghost who is always on my mind and always out of reach. Just wait. Go. Go back. What did Elias whisper in my ear the night he left me for Koff?
It was good. Musa gazes off musingly. Very dramatic. Might use it myself on some lucky girl one day.
Skies, he is insufferable. Do you know if Elias is all right? I tap my fingers on the polished table, trying to check my impatience. Do you know?
My spies don't enter the forest of dusk, Musa says. Too afraid. Forget about your pretty marshal. I can get the information you need.
I also need to know how to stop the Nightbringer, I say. How to fight him. And that's the kind of thing I can find only in books. Can you get me into the Great Library? There must be something there about the history of the djinn. About how the scholars beat them before.
Ah.
Musa spears a slice of apple and pops it into his mouth, then shakes his head.
That could take some time, as I'm banned from it. I'd suggest you sneak into the library. But King Ermond has contracted Jaduna to ward off any fey creatures trying to do exactly that.
Jaduna? I shudder. Nan told stories of the hot-tempered magic wielders said to live in the poisoned lands west of the Empire. I'd prefer not to find out if the tales are true.
Musa nods. Exactly, he says. They sniff out magic like sharks sniff out blood. Trust me, you wouldn't want to cross one of them.
But
fret not. We'll think of something else. And in the meantime, you can start carrying out your part of our deal.
Listen, I try to sound reasonable. I don't think Musa will be willing to listen to this argument more than once. You must see that I have no idea how—
You're not getting out of this, he says. Stop trying. I do not expect you to recruit 100 fighters tomorrow, he says, or next week, or even next month. First, you have to be someone worth listening to, someone worth following. For that to happen, the scholars in Odisha and in the camps need to know who you are and what you've done. And that means that for now, all I need from you is a story.
A story?
Yes, your story. Get yourself a cup of tea, Laya. I think we'll be here a while.
I spend my days with Darin, pumping bellows and shoveling mounds of coal into a furnace, trying to make sure that the spray of sparks that explodes with every strike of his hammer doesn't burn down the forge. We battle across the courtyard to test his blades, most of which break. But he keeps at it, and every day he spends at the forge makes him stronger, more like his old self. It is as if lifting the hammer has reminded him of the man he was before Koth, and the man he wants to be now. I, meanwhile, have no purpose at all other than to wait.
No sneaking around outside the forge. Musa's said it a dozen times. The Jaduna I spoke of report to the king. If they see you, you'll find yourself back in prison, and I don't fancy having to rescue you again.
If Musa has information for me, he doesn't share it, nor do we have any news from the outside world. With every day that goes by, I am more mistrustful. Does the scholar man truly intend to help me, or are his promises to aid me a ploy to get Darin to make weapons? A week flies past, then another. The grain moon is a mere 8 weeks away, and I am spending my time testing blades that keep breaking. One morning, while Musa is out, I sneak into his quarters, hoping to find something, anything, about his past, the resistance or his information network. But all I discover is that he has a taste for candied almonds, which I find tucked away in drawers, beneath the bed, and most bizarrely, in a set of old boots. On most evenings, Musa introduces me to other scholars he knows and trusts. Some are refugees, like me, but many are decent scholars. Every time I have to tell my story again, every time, Musa refuses to explain his plan for resurrecting the resistance.
What were you thinking, Shaver? Why did you send me to this man?
News finally arrives in the form of a scroll that appears in Musa's hand one day in the middle of dinner. Darin and Zella are deep in conversation. Tore is telling me the story of a girl she's fallen for in the camps, and I'm staring daggers at Musa, who is placidly stuffing his face as if the fate of the world doesn't hinge on his ability to get me information. My fixed glare is the only reason I even see the scroll appear. One second, it's not there. The next, he's unrolling it.
The Nightbringer, he says, is in Navium, with the Commandant, the Paters of the city, the Bloodshrike, and her men. He hasn't left there in weeks. There is some infighting between the Commandant and the Bloodshrike, apparently.
I groan. That doesn't help me at all. I need to know whom he's seeing, whom he's talking to.
Apparently, he's spent a great deal of time in his chambers, recovering from sinking the Marshal fleet, Musa says. Must take a lot of energy, murdering a few thousand souls and sending their vessels to the bottom of the sea.
I need more, I say. He has to be doing something beyond sitting in his quarters. Are there any fey creatures around him? Are they getting stronger? How fare the tribes? But Musa has nothing more to offer. Not yet, anyway. Which means I have to take matters into my own hands. I need to get out into the city. Jaduna or not, I need to at least learn what's happening elsewhere in the Empire. After dinner, as Darin, Tore, and Zella discuss the different clays used for cooling a blade, I yawn and excuse myself.
Musa has long since retired, and I pause outside his room. Snores rumble within. Moments later, I am invisible, and cutting my way west toward Adisa's central markets. Though I was only in the refugee camp for moments, the difference between it and the Mariner City is stark. The camp was dingy tents and sucking mud. Adisa's cobbled streets are lined with houses of azure and violet, more alive at night than during the day. The camp was full of young scholars with jutting collarbones and swollen bellies. Here, I don't see a single starving child. What kind of king would allow this? Is there no space in this massive city for the scholars' souls freezing beyond its gates? Maybe it's not the king. Maybe it's his ghoul-infested daughter. The creatures flit through the market, too, a seething blight lurking on the fringes of the crowds. In the city's center, brightly dressed mariners haggle and joke and trade. Silk kites sail like ships overhead, and I stop to ogle clay vessels with entire books painted on their sides. An Ankenese seer from the far south rasps out fortunes, and a coal-eyed Jaduna watches him, the gold coins strung across her forehead, catching the light, recalling Musa's warning. I head away from the woman. All around me, mariners walk the streets with a surety I fear I will never possess. The freedom of this place, the ease of it, it feels like none of it is for me or my people. All this belongs to others, to those who do not abide at the crossroads of uncertainty and despair. It belongs to people so used to living free that they cannot imagine a world in which they are not.
Do you expect? The tribes won't lie down and take it like the scholars. They won't allow their people to be enslaved.
Two mariner cooks argue loudly over the pop of frying pastries, and I inch closer.
I understand their anger, one of them says, but to target innocent villagers.
Someone jostles me, and I just manage to hold on to my invisibility. The crowds here are too thick, so I leave them behind, not stopping until I spot a group of children gathered in a doorway.
She burned Blackcliff to a crisp and killed a mask.
A few are decent scholars, full-cheeked and finely dressed. Others are mariners. All cluster around wanted signs featuring me, Darin, and, I'm surprised to see, Musa.
I heard she stabbed Koff's warden in the face. I think she'll save us from the wraiths.
All I need from you is a story, Musa had said. It is strange to hear that story now, altered into something else entirely.
Uncle Musa says she's got magic, like the lioness. My da says Uncle Musa is a liar. He says the lioness was a fool and a murderess.
My ama says the lioness killed children. My heart twists. I know their words shouldn't bother me. They are only children. But I want to show myself anyway. She was funny and clever, I want to say. She could shoot a sparrow on a branch from 100 paces. She only ever wanted true freedom for us. For you. She only ever wanted better. Another child appears in the alley.
Kahani! Kahani!
She yells. The children race away to a nearby courtyard where a deep voice rises and trembles and swoops, a Kihani spinning a tail. I follow them to find the yard bursting with an audience, collectively holding its breath. The Kehani has silver hair and a face that has seen 1,000 tales. She wears a heavily embroidered, calf-length dress over wide, mirror-hemmed pants that catch the lamplight. Her voice is throaty, and though I should move on, I find an empty spot against a wall to listen.
The ghouls surrounded the child, drawn by his sadness.
She speaks, Saren, and her accent is heavy.
And though he wished to help his ailing sister, The fey creatures whispered poison into his ears until his heart became as twisted as the roots of an old gin tree.
As the Kahani sings her story, I realize there is truth within this tale. A history of sorts. Hadn't I just witnessed exactly what she described, only with Princess Nikla? The Kihani stories, I realize, have as much history in them as any book in the Great Library. More, perhaps, for there is no skepticism in the old tales that might occlude the truth. The more I consider it, the more excited I get. Elias learned to destroy a Fritz from a song Mamie Wheeler sang him. What if the stories could help me understand the Nightbringer? What if they could tell me how to stop him? My excitement has me moving away from the wall, toward the Kehani. Finally, I have a chance to learn something useful about the djinn.
Liar.
The whisper brushes against my ear and I jump, jostling the man next to me who yelps, looking about for whoever bumped him. Quick as I can, I weave my way through the still rapt audience and out of the courtyard. Something is watching me. I feel it. And whatever it is, I don't want it making trouble among those listening to the Kehani. I shove back through the crowded market, looking over my shoulder repeatedly. Black scraps of shadow flit just out of my vision. Ghouls? Or something worse? I speed my gait, exiting the market and entering a quiet side street. I look back once more.
The past shall burn, and none will slow it.
I recognize the whisper, the way it grates like rotted claws across my mind. Nightbringer. I am too frightened even to cry out. All I can do is stand there, useless. I spin, trying to pick him out of the shadows. Show yourself! My voice is barely above a whisper. Show yourself, you monster!
You dare to judge me, liar of Sarah. How can you, when you know not the darkness that lives within your own heart?
I'm not afraid of you. The words are a lie, and he chuckles in response. I blink, an instant of darkness, nothing at all, and when I open my eyes, I sense I am alone again. The Nightbringer is gone. By the time I return to the forge, my body trembles. The place is dark. Everyone has turned in. But I don't drop my invisibility until I'm alone in my room. The moment I do, my vision goes black. I am standing in a room, a cell, I realize. I can just make out a woman in the darkness. She is singing.
A star, she came into my home, lit it bright with glory.
The song floats all around me, though the words grow muffled. A strange sound splits the song, like the branch of a tree breaking. When I open my eyes, the vision is gone, as is the singing. The house is quiet, other than Darin murmuring in his sleep from next door. What in the skies was that? Is it the magic affecting me? Or the Nightbringer? Is this him? Is he toying with my mind? I sit up quickly, glancing about my darkened room. Elias's armlet is warm in my hand. I imagine his voice.
The shadows are just shadows, liar. The Nightbringer can't hurt you.
But he can. He has. He'll do so again. I retreat to my bed, refusing to release the armlet, trying to keep Elias's soothing baritone in my mind. But I keep seeing the Nightbringer's face, hearing his voice, and sleep does not come.
Chapter 18. Elias. The djinn know I'm coming. The moment I reach their grove, I'm unnerved by an expectant sort of quiet, a waiting. Strange how silence can speak as loudly as a scream. Yes, they know I'm here, and they know I want something.
Hail, mortal!
My skin crawls at the choral voice of the djinn.
Come to beg forgiveness for your existence?
I've come to ask for help. The djinn's laughter knifes at my ears. I do not wish to trouble you. It irks, but humility might serve me well. I certainly can't brazen my way through this. I know you suffer. I know what was done to you long ago is the heart of your suffering. And I've been imprisoned too.
You think the horrors of your puny human prison can begin to approach our torment?
Skies, why did I say that? Stupid. I don't wish pain like that on anyone. A long silence, and then...
You are like her.
Like Shaver, I say. But the magic bonded with her, and it won't bond with me.
Like your mother, Keris.
The djinn sensed my dismay and laugh.
You think not? Perhaps you do not know her as well as you think you do. Or perhaps, mortal, you do not know yourself.
I'm not a heartless murdering.
The magic of the soul catcher will never be yours. You are too deeply linked to those you love, too open to pain. Your kind is weak. Even Keris Victoria could not release her mortal attachments.
The only thing my mother is attached to is power. I sense that in their arboreal prison, the djinn are smug.
How little you know, boy. Your mother's story lives in your blood. Her past, her memory, it is there. We could show you.
The silk in their voices reminds me of the time a senior skull tried to tell 14-year-old me to come to his room, so he could show me a new blade his father gave him.
You wish to know her better, deep in your heart,
the djinn say.
Do not lie to us, Elias Vittorius, for when you are in our grove, your subterfuge is for naught. We see all.
Something rough slithers past my ankles. Vines rise up out of the earth like giant, bark-encrusted snakes. They twist up around my legs, locking me into place. I try to draw my sims, but the vines bind the weapons to my back and coil around my shoulders, holding me fast.
Stop this! Stop!
The djinn shove their way into my mind, probing and turning and examining it, bringing their fire to places that were never meant to see the light. I push back at them, but to no avail. I am trapped in my own head, in my memories. I see myself as a babe again, looking up into the silver face of a woman whose long blonde hair is darkened with sweat. The commandant's hands are bloody, her face flushed. Her body trembles, but when she touches my face, her fingers are gentle.
You look like him, she whispers.
She doesn't look angry, though I always thought she would. Instead, she appears perplexed, almost bewildered. Then I'm watching myself as a young boy of 4, wandering through Camp Scythe, a thick jacket buttoned up to my chin against the chill winter night. While the other tribal children have clustered around Mamie Reeler to hear a terrifying tale about the King of No Name, I watch as young Elias walks to the rocky desert beyond the circle of wagons. The galaxy is a pale cloud across the onyx sky, the night bright enough for me to pick my way forward. From the west, a rhythmic thump draws close. A horse materializes on a nearby ridge. A woman dismounts, her gleaming armor flashing beneath heavy tribal robes. A dozen blades glint from her chest and back. The wind whips at the hard, dry earth around her. In the glowing starlight, her blonde hair is the same silver as her face.
This didn't happen, I think wildly. I don't remember it. She left me. She never came back.
Karis Veturia drops to one knee, but remains a few feet away, as if she doesn't want to scare me. She appears so young, I can scarcely fathom it is her.
What is your name?
At last, I recognize something about her. That hard voice, as cold and unfeeling as the land beneath our feet.
Ilias. Ilias.
The commandant draws my name out, as if searching for its meaning.
Go back to the caravan, Ilias. Dark creatures walk the desert at night.
I don't hear my response, because I am now in a room outfitted with nothing but a cot, a desk, and a wide fireplace. The arched windows and thick walls, along with the scent of salt, tell me I'm in Navium. Summer has come swiftly to the south, and heavy warm air pours through the window. Despite that, a fire burns in the grate. Karis is older than she was when I last saw her months ago, just before she poisoned me. She lifts up her undershirt and examines what looks to be a bruise, though it is difficult to tell, since her skin is silver. I remember then that she stole the Bloodshrike's shirt of living metal long ago. It has fused to her body as closely as her mask has fused to her face. Her Always Victo tattoo is clearly visible beneath the silver of the shirt, except now it says Always Victori. As she feels out the bruise, I notice a strange object in the room, all the more unusual against the simplicity of the quarters. It's a crude clay sculpture of a mother holding a child. The commandant studiously ignores it. She drops her shirt and puts her armor back on. As she stares into the mottled mirror, her gaze shifts to the statue. She watches it in the reflection, wary, as if it might come to life. Then she turns on her heel, snatches it up, and tosses it, almost casually, into the hearth fire. She calls through the closed door. Moments later, a slave enters. The commandant nods at the burning sculpture.
You found it, she says. Did you speak to anyone of it?
At the man's denial, the commandant nods and beckons him closer.
Don't do it, I want to tell him. Flee.
My mother's hands blur as she breaks his neck. I wonder if he even felt it.
Let's keep it that way, she says to his slumped body. Shall we?
I blink, and I am back in the gin grove. No vines drag me down to the forest floor, and dawn paints the grove red and orange. Hours have passed. The gin still scuttle through my mind. I fight back, shoving them out, pushing into their consciousness. Their surprise is palpable, and their guard drops for a moment. I feel their rage, their shock, a shared, deep pain, and a swiftly suppressed panic. A furtiveness. Then I am cast out.
You're hiding something, I gasp. You... Look to your borders, Ilias Veturius,
the djinn snarl.
See what we have wrought.
An attack. I feel it as clearly as I'd feel an attack on my own body. But this assault doesn't come from outside the forest. It comes from within.
Go and see the horror of ghosts who break free of the waiting place. See your people ravaged. You cannot change it. You cannot stop it.
I curse, hearing the augur's words from so long ago thrown back in my face. I windwalk to the southern border with a speed that would rival Shaver's. When I arrive, thousands of ghosts cluster in one spot, pushing against the border with single-minded violence, almost feral with the desire to escape. I reach for Martha, for the magic, but I might as well be grasping at air. The ghosts part as I make my way through them, their shrieking disappointment reverberating in my bones. The border appears whole, but spirits might still have escaped. I run my hands over the glowing gold wall, trying to find any weaknesses. Far in the distance, the red and blue of Tribe Nassau's wagons gleam in the morning light, the smoke of cook fires fading into a stormy sky. To my surprise, the encampment has grown and moved closer to the forest. I recognize the green and gold draped wagons curved in a circle not far from the shore of the Duskan Sea. Tribe Nur, Afya's tribe, has joined Arboretz. Why is Afya here? With the marshals so belligerent, the tribes shouldn't congregate in one place. Afya's savvy enough to know that.
Banu Al-Ma'atha?
Arboret appears from a dip in the land just ahead. Fakira! I step out of the forest, my pulse still thundering in warning, though I sense nothing out of the ordinary.
Now isn't really a good... Elias, bleeding victorious!
I know the small woman who shoves past Arboret by the fire in her eyes, for in every other way she is unrecognizable. Her face is lined, and the kerchief that hides her usually impeccable braids cannot mask their disarray. Purple shadows nest beneath her eyes, and I smell the sharp tang of sweat.
What the hell's is going on? Zaldara!
Arboret looks scandalized.
You will address him as the Banu... Do not call him that. His name is Elias Victorious. He is a foolish man, just like any other foolish man. And I suspect he is the reason Tribe Nur's ghosts are stuck.
Afya, slow down, I say. What in ten hells? My voice chokes off as Martha tugs violently at me, almost pulling me off my feet. I sense the urgency behind the summons and whip around. Floating on the breeze just a few yards away, a face materializes. It's contorted, angry, and moving swiftly toward the tribal encampments. Another follows it, called to the distant caravan like vultures drawn to carrion. Some of the ghosts escaped. Before I arrived, they got out. Perhaps they will only drift about, wailing and pining for life. They have no bodies. They can't actually do anything. I barely even formed the thought when, with chilling suddenness, a flock of birds lifts from the trees near the caravans, cawing in alarm.
Elias!
Afya speaks, but I jerk my hand up. For a moment, all is quiet. And then, the screaming begins.
Chapter 19. The Bloodshrike. Bloodshrike. Summer is in full bloom in Antium, and it grows difficult to hide from the heat. The Emperor rejoices in the change of seasons, though he is much troubled by the concerns of the crown. The seasonal storms are as bad as the heat, and no one at court is unaffected. I offer aid where I can, but it is challenging. I am thankful every day for the plebeians. Their support of both the Emperor and myself is a comfort during this trying time. Loyal to the end, Empress Livia Aquila Farrar. Someone opened Livia's letter long before it got to me. My sister's attempts to code her thoughts, while clever, are useless. By now the Commandant will know that she is well into her pregnancy. The Nightbringer will have told her. As for the rest of the letter, Karis will have deciphered that as well. That Livia can't hide the pregnancy for much longer. That the Emperor grows more unstable. That my sister keeps the wolves at bay. That plebeian support is all that allows Marcus to remain on the throne. That I must defeat the Commandant soon, if I want Livia and her child to survive. I read the letter while wandering Navium's southern beach, which is littered with the wreckage of the fleet.
tattered sails, moss-covered masts, weathered scraps of wood. All a proof of my failure to protect the city. As I kneel to run my hands over a piece of ocean smooth.